to the Creative Pen Podcasts. I'm Joanna Penn, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options, internet sales and promotion for your book. The companion website is www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, this is Joanna Penn from The Creative Pen, and today I have a fantastic guest on the show. Carolyn Kaufman is a psychologist and the author of A Writer's Guide to Psychology. She is just a fantastic source of information, and you're going to love the interview that I've done with her. We get into the sort of lots of stuff about psychology, but we also talk about some supernatural things, and I ask her some, you know, quite different questions. So it's a brilliant interview, so I hope you stay on the show. In the meantime, a little update for you. So basically, it is, when I'm recording this, it's during the launch week of Pentecost, and it's been a pretty exciting time so far. And I wanted to briefly tell you how it feels to have Pentecost finally available for sale, and also how the launch went, because I know a lot of, you know, people listening are authors and do marketing for their own books. So it's really good for us all to learn from each other. So on the happy side, I'm really pleased that the book is finally out in the world. It's been sort of 14 months pretty much since I started it. So I'm really pleased it's out there and people are reading it. I've got some brilliant reviews on Amazon.com. Thank you all for your support. So the best rankings I've had so far that I've seen, number 17 in religious fiction on the US Kindle store. I think I'm pretty much in the religious fiction genre. I'm accepting of that, so that's quite exciting. Number 17 is pretty good, and it's staying up there in the top 100, so that's excellent. I did get into number 96 in the UK on amazon.co.uk under thriller fiction in my paperback, which was interesting, and also number 9 in Christian fiction in the UK. So I did actually make Amazon bestseller lists, and I have the screen prints to prove it. So I will be doing a blog post on all of the things that I've been doing. You can also check out all the guest posts I've been doing. You know, it's just been crazy. I think I did around 25, and I've been doing audio interviews, some video interviews. It's just been a fun time. So yeah, I'm pretty tired in general. But thank you for your support, and the book is out there now. Clearly, it's not just about launch week. It's about, you know, ongoing. So if you like kick-ass thrillers with religious and psychological themes, check it out on Amazon and other online retailers. It's available in print and e-format. So that's the happy side, and I wanted to tell you that I am really pleased, but I also wanted to be honest with you, because, you know, you guys are my audience and we can share these things. I've also felt strangely depressed and almost like an anti-climax, as in it's out there and I'm not as famous as Dan Brown with my first novel, and you know, that's pretty much not what I could have expected, really. But you know, I guess I feel a little bit like an anti-climax, but this is normal. It's the result of spending so long to create the book, and now it feels like it's over. But in a way, it's almost just beginning. I've got I'm starting on Prophecy, which is the next one. I've got an idea for Pilgrim, which will be the following one, and also Pendragon, which will be the one after that. So I mean, I've got all these ideas, but right now I just feel like it's been a lot of work, and yeah, I guess it's just the beginning. But it kind of also feels like an end, if you know what I mean. I also feel kind of weirded out, because people are reading my thoughts. You know, if you pick up a book, there's this bending of space and time, and you're reading the thoughts that I thought, you know, months ago or whatever. And although Pentecost is clearly fiction, there are some of my experiences in there. You know, not obviously the violent stuff about burning people to death and things like that, but certainly on the travel side, there are some of my thoughts, and I guess I am afraid of judgment and criticism. I have written a genre fiction novel. It's a fast-paced action-adventure thriller. It is Clive Cussler. It is Matthew Riley, Dan Brown. You know, it is James Rollins. You know, it's not Pulitzer Prize-winning fiction. It was never meant to be. So I know the inevitable criticism comes. But hey, It's fine. And I actually wrote a post on Tribal Writer, Justine Musk's site, where I actually wrote about being afraid of judgment and criticism because I knew I would be feeling like this. So I just wanted to let you all know how it feels to me, and I'm pretty sure that you would have the same experiences. Feel free to leave a comment on the blog or email me if you understand. Joanna@thecreativepen.com. So yeah, pretty exhausted. There was a lot of adrenaline before the launch. I was also really worried that I wouldn't sell a single book, so I'm glad that didn't happen. But I went to bed early last night and finally feel a bit better, so that's good. And let's face it, the marketing of a book is a continuous thing. I've also been reminded of a brilliant audiobook, I think it's also a print book, by Clarissa Pinkola Estes, who wrote The Women Who Run With Wolves. She's quite a, I guess, quite a spiritual, out there kind of writer. But she wrote all about the creative fire, and I actually downloaded that a few months ago and was listening, and how there are seasons of creativity. She talks about the cycle of creation and how the down patches come along with the highly creative times, how that kind of cycle is entirely natural. And I guess I feel like I'm at the end of a cycle, and I'm going to have to be a bit gentle with myself before I carry on. So I need to recharge before I get on with the next book or the next thing in general. So anyway, I wanted to share that with you, as my audience. I want to continue to be honest with you on this journey as a writer. And I know a lot of you are on the journey with me. A lot of you are ahead of me. And of course, some people are just starting. So I hope that we can all help each other along the way. Okay, on with the interview with Carolyn, which is also on psychology. And we do talk about a lot of things. We actually do talk about the psychology of creativity as well. So I hope you enjoy the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from The Creative Pen, and today I'm interviewing Carolyn Kaufman. Carolyn is a professor and doctor of clinical psychology, as well as the author of The Writer's Guide to Psychology. She also writes science fiction and fantasy and blogs at archetypewriting.com and querytracker.net. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show because I have a very personal interest in psychology, so thank you. So maybe you could start by telling us a bit more about your writing and your psychology background and why you wrote the book.
Okay. I started out writing when I was very young, but when I was in graduate school, I noticed that what I was seeing in the therapy room and in my classes was very different from what I was seeing, like in movies and books and that kind of a thing. And so I got interested in it while I was in graduate school and actually did my dissertation on a related topic. But when I got into teaching, I sort of realized that my students also had a lot of misconceptions and that kind of a thing. So it became very natural to try to put the things together that I like to do, teaching, writing, psychology, into a book. I had noticed when I looked that there was no guide manual for people who wanted to get the information accurate. You know, there are consultants out there, and they're not necessarily accessible to everybody. And so I wanted something that would be accessible and affordable and interesting for the average person who writes.
Yeah, and it is a great book. Maybe you could just outline the book so that people can understand what's actually in it.
Oh, okay. So it's called The Writer's Guide to Psychology, as you said, and the original goal was to help people write accurately about psychological disorders, human behavior, that kind of a thing. And it's intended for not just fiction writers, but also for journalists and producers and that kind of a thing. And it goes through and it talks a lot about what therapy is like, and what it's really like, not what you imagine it's like, because there's a lot of fictional portrayals that are very much inaccurate. And so the book talks about what therapy's like, how therapists get people to talk, because sometimes it can be hard to get our characters, to tell us why they're doing what they're doing. It talks a lot about disorders in an accurate way, medications, hospitalization, that kind of a thing. But again, it's not like an intro to psychology guide, it's more for writers. So I tried to get into enough depth that you would be able to write a story and make it really ring with accuracy.
Yeah, No, and I think that's a great thing. I actually was going to ask you, you know, briefly about defining psychology, because the word itself is bandied around, you know, by everybody. You know, this is psychology, that's psychology. You know, what's your definition of psychology? And so, you know, which drives why it's important, I guess.
Right. Well, typically what we say in classes, especially, so sort of the standardized answer is it's the science of mind and behavior. And so we're really trying to understand why people do what they do, but we want to study it in a very empirical way. We want to look at the research. We don't want to just make assumptions, which is what most of us do.
Right. Okay. No, that's great. So what are some of the typical aspects that writers get wrong or that you've seen, you know, wrong in film and books and things?
Right, right. Actually, I took a couple notes, so if I'm glancing it off the side, that's what I'm doing. You know, I think that a lot of people assume that everybody uses what's called psychodynamic therapy, which is the assumption that everybody wants to know about your childhood and your unconscious, which is not necessarily the case. In fact, only a few types of therapists are really interested in that. There are some therapists that if you start talking about your childhood, they're actually going to go, wait a minute, let's focus on the present. Let's not distract from, you know, where the issue really is, that kind of a thing. Obviously, most therapists don't make you lie down on the couch. In fact, most therapists would be freaked out if you lay down on the couch. I had people try that a couple times when I was doing therapy. I was like, no, sit up. It's okay. What else? Creating stereotypical therapists. There are actually four types of therapists that are stereotypes. Number one is Dr. Sexy, who's usually a female, right? So she's, you know, looking flinky and hot at her client and, you know, that kind of thing. And then there's Dr. Wonderful, who makes all the brilliant interpretations, gets everything right, knows exactly what to do. Usually Dr. Wonderful is actually the writer in disguise, you know, who's trying to share information. There's Dr. Evil, who always has an evil plot of some kind, who, you know, is going to do experiments or do electroshock therapy for no apparent reason, that kind of thing. Or Dr. Dippy, who's the one we make fun of. So he's just kind of like, can't get anything right, doesn't get it, he's just sort of an idiot. And so the character can go in and make the psychologist look bad and himself look good. And then one other one that I wanted to mention is, not showing disorders accurately or consistently, which is a lot of times if a writer gives a character a disorder, they will not show it consistently. So the character only has the disorder when it's convenient for the story, which is not really how it works.
Yeah, no, I can see that. And there's, you know, we can take some artistic license, but I guess it's important to get things right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even more so than it used to be, just because more and more people are doing therapy and are more familiar with how these things work.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned Dr. Evil there, and I was just reminded when you were saying that. I mean, obviously, psychology and psychiatry now is, you know, generally a humane and nice thing. But if we look back, you know, not that many years, even 50 years ago, you know, psychiatry particularly and psychology could be seen as quite evil itself. You know, we look back at the Institute. Maybe you could just, you know, talk a bit about that. And if people are writing more historical books, what they'll have to look for.
Okay. Some of the things that are dirty little secrets that we sort of, you know, a lot of people try to sweep under the carpet are things like institutions used to be very overcrowded, and they used to do things like put people in straitjackets and leave them in those straitjackets for days at a time. And, you know, if you imagine having somebody wrap you up that way for even an hour, it would be very painful. And so it was just, we didn't understand the mental illness well enough. We didn't understand what to do with it. And so it was sort of like just get people out of the way. So that happened a lot in the 1800s. In addition to that, there were lobotomies where they went in and actually destroyed the front of the brain. And they would either inject acid or scoop it out with basically a spoon. And it was really, really awful, because what they would do is they would actually have the person be awake and they'd have them talk or sing or recite the Lord's Prayer or something like that. And when the person became incoherent, they'd be like, oh, yes, we did too much. So really, really awful. And then the other thing that usually comes up is electroshock therapy, which is very, very humane now when it's done.
Yeah.
At least in most westernized countries. But they used to do it in a way that was, they called it unmodified, an unmodified electroshock therapy was the shaking and people were scared and it could even break bones if people had strong enough convulsions.
Mm. Yeah, so I think it's important if, you know, because a lot of people are writing, you know, historical style, you know, novels now. And if you look, like, psychology now is a far, far cry from what it used to be, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really important. Okay, and so I wanted to ask you as well about the whole psychological disorder thing, because, you know, if you look in the, you know, the DSM-4 and you read it, just some of the words, you just think, oh my goodness, I'm like that and I'm like that, you know. Is it true that we're all on a scale somewhere and that a disorder is right up one end and we're all somewhere there?
Somewhere at the other end. Well, there's, first of all, I have to say that that tendency to read the DSM and see yourself in it, is we call it intern syndrome, because when you're studying the DSM, you're like, I got this. Oh, I have this too, and this. So that's very, like, a really normal type of a thing. And even I may mention it in the book, because I think anytime you're looking over disorders, there's a temptation. You go, oh yeah, that's me, or that's my brother, that's my mother, that's my dad, that kind of thing. I don't agree that everybody is diagnosable. That's not quite what you're asking, but some people do believe everybody is diagnosable. That's not the case. You can say, though, that a lot of behaviors that are diagnosable, that we all exhibit sort of mild versions of those things. So, for example, like a major depression, everybody gets blue sometimes. Mm-hmm. Or a major anxiety disorder, everybody gets anxious once in a while. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I do think that there is a continuum and it's on the really far end where we see disorders.
Hmm. No, and I like that idea because it means we can almost have a small insight into how people feel. And we can use that as writers to try and tap into the bigger issues, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just on that as well, I was just thinking before the phone call, I read quite a lot of Kay Redfield Jamison's books about creativity, suicide, and, you know, she's brilliant. And one of her books is about kind of bipolar disorder, manic depression, and its relation to creativity. You know, maybe Van Gogh had it or whatever, obviously before they were diagnosable. What do you think about that? Do we have to have some awful mental disorder to become wonderfully creative?
I don't think that we do. And it's interesting because I, like you, have read a lot about that. I'm real interested in that connection between mental illness and creativity. And Redfield Jamison talks a lot about mood disorders, bipolar disorder in particular, like you said. I recently read a book that was really interesting and said that a lot of creative people are invested in the idea of writers being mentally ill. They kind of almost like the idea of us being a little eccentric and different. And so there are people who sort of believe that we are looking for it more than it's actually there. So, you know, everybody sort of has an opinion. I guess I'm of the opinion that, yes, I do think that there is a link. I think the research is strong enough to say that there is a link. What they find, though, when they actually start to treat people who have those disorders is that they're creativity often improves rather than getting worse. So, you know, I have people that would come into therapy and say, well, I don't want you to mess up my creativity, you know, which I can relate to. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, we need to be very aware as we look at medications and things like that, because once in a while somebody will take a medication and it'll, like, numb them out, they'll say, or it'll interfere with their creativity. And it's like, well, then we need to move on to something else. And also to sort of keep it in mind as you do therapy, that kind of a thing. But overall, their creativity tends to improve if they get adequate treatment. I guess I should go back to the original question was, do we all have to be a little crazy? Well, we all have to be a little crazy to want to be writers, but do we all be mentally ill now?
No, exactly. Not, you know, I'm with you. It's just a fascinating area. And, you know, one that I guess will continue to be investigated as we learn more about the brain. Now, you have a chapter on the villain, you know, the evil guy, that, you know, we all apply certain psychological traits to that. Maybe you could just give us a bit of an overview of, you know, writing good villains and why people do what they do.
Okay. Well, I think there are a couple of stereotypes that we see a lot with villains. And so, one is the real cold, slick villain who just He's insane. He's brilliant. You know, and he does things that we don't understand. And a lot of times he's sort of almost a cardboard cutout character because everybody's familiar with it. The other one is the psychotic killer. And, you know, that one acts a little bit crazier, but is still on the same kind of path. I think that in a lot of cases, it's such a stereotype that we forget to actually create a villain who's interesting and a villain who has a good motivation and then villain who maybe even makes a little bit of sense. So I think I'm biased in thinking that villains, we should understand a little bit about what's going on with them and maybe even be able to relate to them a little bit, because I think it makes them more interesting if we can appreciate where they're coming from. One of the things that's kind of interesting for writers is a lot of writers are uncomfortable delving into the mind of the villain because they're afraid that that means bad things about them. You know, oh, I can think of this. But I think that writers like Stephen King have proven that being able to do that can be very lucrative. So, you know, again, I think that just being able to sort of put yourself in the villain's shoes and try to appreciate really what is motivating him or her, why are they doing this, and then how can I help the reader understand that?
No, that's interesting. And I wondered, one of the studies I'm continuously fascinated with is the Milgram studies on obedience to authority figures. Yeah. And which explains so much when people, you know, are told to do things. Could you just maybe talk a bit about that? Because I think that's really useful for people who are maybe writing about, you know, war or, you know, where people have to do things. Would you mind talking about that?
No, no. And probably, is it okay if I summarize Milgram a little bit?
Yes, that would be great.
So the Milgram experiments are basically this guy, Stanley Milgram, had people come and sit in an office, and there was a learner and a teacher. And what the teacher's job was to shock the learner if the learner got something wrong. And they weren't actually shocking the learner, but they thought they were shocking the learner. And if an experimenter stood over them and basically told them that they had to do this, they would continue even after they thought they were hurting the person and maybe even killing them. And one of the things that always strikes me as very interesting about them was that some of the teachers would actually beg to be allowed to stop. They wouldn't just stop. They would just ask to be, and they'd break out in hives and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it proved how powerful authority can be. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of reasons that's true. When you look at something like the military, you have to look at how indoctrinated people get. I mean, they're taught to obey without question. And that's important because you don't want a bunch of, you know, soldiers going, but why? Why should I do that? You know, that kind of thing. So something like the military, people are taught to be like that. But we're all taught to respond to authority in such a way that kind of a knee-jerk reaction in a lot of cases. We believe if somebody behaves in an authoritative way that we should respond. I'm not answering this very well.
No, you are. No, that's good. That's what I was thinking. It's kind of like, you know, any kind of authority, and I guess I'm thinking, and I'm twisting this around as well, and I was going to ask you about the psychology of religion again in a minute, but one of the things I'm interested in is when people do things and they say that God told them to do it, and I'm not questioning anybody's faith, I'm just interested as God as an authority figure and how that relates to a study like Milgram's. If people believe God is the ultimate authority, and a lot of evil villains now are religious fundamentalists, you know, so what do you think about that? Do you think the idea of authority can translate into God?
Yeah, I do. I think you kind of have it going both ways. In some ways, people make the argument of, you know, God says this and therefore it's wrong or it's right. And the soapbox that I usually get on is the one about homosexuality. You know, the Bible says it's wrong, therefore it must be wrong. And, you know, again, just like you, I'm not questioning anybody's faith or belief, but at the same time, you know, research suggests that there's a real strong biological component. So it's like there's confusion between what the Bible says and what we've learned through science. And so, you know, God saying this, you know, sometimes I want people to stop and think, now, wait a minute, why would God have said that? And, you know, what might the goal have been? And let's, you know, consider things with the knowledge that we have now. I think it can go the other way, though, too, where people want to have an authority of some kind, and so they sort of project onto God their own beliefs. And I think that some very smart political leaders sometimes use God as an authority, and they project what they want God to be, and then they tell the people, because that can be a very powerful thing in a society that believes strongly in God.
No, that's great. Yeah, I think all of that, so many things relate to the writing, don't they? So, so let's go further into that, because I did, I sort of prepped you with a question on parapsychology and neurotheology and all these things that I'm kind of getting into. But at the moment, people seem to be fascinated with these things on the fringes of well, there's even a TV show called Fringe, isn't there, which is about the edges of these things. What do you think about those aspects?
Well, first of all, I think it's hard not to be fascinated by those things. I know I went through a stage when I was younger when I was just obsessed with that stuff. You know, is it real? Is it not real? And I think that there's something in human beings that seeks the supernatural. In fact, I once saw something that said that every language in the world has a word for soul. And I thought, how fascinating that, you know, there are a lot of things that we don't have in common. I mean, some cultures don't even count past 10 or so, but we all have a word for soul. So there's this search for something supernatural. And then most cultures, if not all cultures, have some kind of higher power somewhere in their history. So we do seem to be in the search for the supernatural. And like I mentioned to you earlier, you know, they've identified an area of the brain that actually has religious feelings. So if they stimulate it with an electrode, people actually will start to have very religious feelings or sometimes religious experiences. And it's been interesting to me to hear the different arguments about that. Some people believe, well, that means obviously that there is a higher power, and the higher power has given us this part of the brain so that we can communicate with it. And other people are like, well, it's obvious that there is no higher power because it's just a brain defect or something like that.
Yeah, so no, I see what you mean. It could go either way, and I think people twist anything to their own beliefs, don't they? That's just human nature. But it's important, I think, to consider it, given that psychology is, you know, the science of mind and behavior. Faith is a key part of human behavior. It's in every culture. Yeah. So that's great. Now, I wanted to ask you about where psychology is going, because clearly there are so many things going on. You know, I'm thinking particularly of how neuroscience is changing things. What do you see in the next couple of years, I guess, as new things we're going to be looking at in psychology?
Right. One of the things that I'm really excited about and very interested in is some of these new treatments that are not chemical in nature. They're not medications. Obviously, as a former therapist, I always think therapy is important, but I think it's really neat that they're starting to work on things like transcranial magnetic stimulation, vagus nerve stimulation, and deep brain stimulation, and I should probably tell you what those are. All three of them are treatments that do not involve any drugs. Transcranial magnetic stimulation is basically you sit back in a chair and they use a magnetic current to stimulate the left hemisphere of the brain, and it pushes neurotransmitters, which are the feel-good brain chemicals, into the brain. The other two, vagus nerve stimulation and deep brain stimulation, are that electrodes are implanted in the body. There's a battery that's placed under the collarbone, and then electrodes that either go up into the neck or into the brain, and that basically get rid of problems like depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, that kind of a thing. And some people think it's really scary because they're like, somebody's going to implant an electrode in my brain, you know? But I think that people who have treatment-resistant depressions or treatment-resistant obsessive compulsive disorder or something like that, they say, like, with deep brain stimulation, that when they implant the electrode, the symptoms just vanish. And I think, what a neat thing, you know? And how nice it would be to go without side effects and not have to worry about that kind of a thing. And they're very expensive treatments and they're still very experimental, but I think they're promising.
And what about smart drugs? You know, there's people who say that's coming, where you can take things, normal people, I say in inverted commas, right, can take smart drugs or this type of treatment and change their brains to be better.
I think, I always think of the, Kurt Vonnegut, Harrison Bergeron. Are you familiar with that story?
Not really.
No. The story is basically that there was a guy, his name was Harrison Bergeron, and he was better than everybody else. He was stronger, smarter, faster, better looking and everything. And so they wanted to make everybody equal. And so what they did was they would handicap him in ways so that he would be just like everybody else. And so in some ways, it's almost like we're going in a direction. We want to make a bunch of super people. You know what I mean? And I think on the one hand, if we can enhance people's lives, you know, and make it easier for them to learn things or that kind of a thing, that's great. On the other hand, I think it's a little scary because I don't know how I feel about people, a lot of people taking drugs that they don't necessarily need. Mm. Because, you know, drugs always have side effects, and even if it's a smart drug, you know, it takes a long time to be able to tell what the long-term effects of a drug are going to be. You don't know how it's going to affect each person. Mm. I already say, and I don't know how much this is the case in other parts of the world, but America is a pill nation. We are all about drugs. You know, you get a headache, you take a pill, you get a stomach ache, you take a pill. You know, you name it, we take a pill for it. Mm. And so what are we doing? We're looking for more pills. And I think in some ways, like I said, that's kind of scary.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I think there's a lot of ideas people can take, you know, even from our conversation, from writing ideas, and certainly any kind of drug is an interesting one. So, right, we're almost out of time, but I read that you were working on a new book on the psychology for writers. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm kind of in the outline stage, and I tell you, working on publicity for a book is a lot more time consuming than I thought it would be. But I do have a goal to write another book for writers, and basically, rather than it being psychology for writers to help them write more accurately about psychology, how to use psychology to improve themselves. And so there are some books like that out there, but I want to go at it with a real research basis underneath it, which is not so really boring. But I want it to be, like, a lot of the books that are out there right now are very much about, I'm a coach, this is what I've experienced, this is what I see work. But I want to look at, you know, what does the research show works? Mm-hmm. And what does it show us about why people procrastinate? And why is it that a lot of the tips that are in these books aren't working for people? Mm-hmm. What can we do differently? What can we learn from research and that kind of a thing? So I want it to be something that's a little bit different, a little more research-based, with some tips that maybe people haven't seen before.
No, that sounds brilliant. And, you know, because a lot of us bloggers in the writing niche, we talk about these questions all the time. You know, how do we deal with criticism of our work? And, you know, those questions come up over and over again. So I think that's a really good idea. Okay, so we're pretty much out of time. Where can people find your book, The Writer's Guide to Psychology?
Probably the best place to find it is online. Amazon.com is a great place to find it. Here in the U.S., they've got it for $10, which is a really good price, $5 less than the cover price. I know that it's also available at, Indigo in Canada, which is an online reseller, and places like Barnes & Noble and Borders online. So I also have a website called Writer's Guide to Psychology.com, and there are links there, too. Mm.
And you have a blog as well. Do you want to tell people about that?
Well, you mentioned the Query Tracker blog, which is a big deal. I really enjoy doing that. I work with several other writers, and we basically help writers work towards a career in writing, get published, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I also have several blogs that I do. One is for Psychology Today. It's called Psychology for Writers, and the goal is to do the things in this book, you know, psychology to improve your writing and make it more accurate, but also the same types of things that I'm thinking about for my new book, which is, you know, dealing with procrastination and those kinds of issues. I also have the Archetype Writing blog, which I a lot of times do question and answer types of things. Mm-hmm. So if a writer has a question about a story that they're working on, they can actually send me their question, I'll respond, and then often post it on the Archetype Writing blog. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Right, well, thanks ever so much for your time, Carolyn. That was great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You can get more information on writing, publishing options, sales, and promotion for your book at www.thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And you can also get your free How to Be an Author workbook at www.howtobeanauthor.com. See you next time!